Animalshow.com.
Animalshow.com.
You have to realize that to understand the Israel-Palestine question, this peculiarity that a historically oppressed people is actually implementing apartheid, land theft, genocide, and it's kind of embarrassing. It also is awkward. You know why it's awkward? Because it disturbs a liberal mentality. And the Black Power movement, as represented by SNCC, when it raised the Palestine question, it was also critiquing liberalism. And what is liberalism? Liberalism is a philosophy that says our system of government is basically good, but it needs certain reforms. That we would have a more accountable government if we maintain the same sense of system of hierarchy and domination, but we kind of diversify the identities and the voices in the system. And this mentality goes back to the early 70s, when Anglo-America began to totter and began to be shattered under the moral authority of the Black liberation struggle in this country. And so when we see this, we have to keep in mind that the only way we're going to be able to advance the struggle to defend the Palestinians, the only way we're going to be able to authentically support this, if you heard about it, the divestment from Israel movement, or this movement called BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is to be honest with the fact that we're not going to be able to establish this by lobbying President Obama. You know, in 2005, this BDS, what they call BDS, had came on the scene. But divestment from Israel existed before that, as represented by some of my activism, but I'm not a prominent person. But the people Lenny's age, they're going at it way longer than I, okay? But the BDS emerged in response to, really, the election of Obama, in the hope that the State Department, under a different leadership, perhaps a different sensitive leadership, would give the Palestinians a fairer deal. And this is the dilemma or the contradiction of Alice Walker, even though she was placed under severe attack and disrespect by the Anti-Defamation League. I like to call them the African Defamation League, because while they try to say that they're concerned with diversity and anti-racism for all, they sure find a way to disrespect Black people's sovereignty and independence constantly, while they arrogantly speak, you know, somehow with this universal premise that, hey, we're Jews, we're concerned about oppression. But see, they're Zionists, and they're supporters of the American foreign policy that conquers and subordinates people of color nations all over the world. They would say, well, of course, we're not racist. Look, we support the president. Well, that standard has got to be swept aside if we're going to clarify how to best express solidarity toward the Palestinians and really all oppressed people all over the world. And what this book does is it documents the highlights of African American political leaders, particularly Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, later known as Kwame Ture, and others, Huey Newton, and says, look, these are the high points of the expression of this solidarity, but also these are some of the awkward moments, here's some of the contradictions, and with a little greater clarity, not only can we advance solidarity with the Palestinians, but we could also build a democratic and anti-racist and anti-imperialist United States. That's why I support the Palestinians. The Palestinian cause is not a charity abroad. Well, otherwise we're living in such a wonderful place that respects everybody, right? This is a cause that when we discuss this so-called most difficult question in the world and get to the bottom of it, and we get to the bottom of how historically oppressed people's identity has been used to subordinate other oppressed people, then we start to learn something not just about the Middle East, but how the empire works at home, in our own time, in our own country.
Hi, my name is Lenny Brenner, and I am the author of Zionism in the Age of the Dictators. And what it is it's a book about Nazi Zionist, Zionist collaboration with the Nazis, okay? And on the cover is a big photo of a Nazi medal that was involved in the relationship between the Nazis and the Zionists. What happened was that in 1933, when Hitler came to power, the Zionists figured, hey, Nazis, you want us out of Germany, we want the Jews in Palestine. So they got very friendly with the Nazis, and they got a Nazi SS man named von Mildenstein to go to Palestine as the guest of the German Zionist Federation, and then write some articles for the Nazi newspaper Der Angriff, which means the assault, on behalf of Zionism. So after he went there and after he wrote the articles, Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister, had a medal made to commemorate the trip. And this is it. Now, on one side, there's a Star of David, which is the Zionist symbol, and it says in German, of course, a Nazi fahrt nach Palästina, which means a Nazi travels to Palestine. And on the other side is a swastika, and it says in German, unser Erzalt Baben im Angriff, and wrote about it in Angriff, which was the propaganda ministry's propaganda newspaper. It means the assault, like a punch in the mouth or something like that. And these are very rare, and but as I say, if you buy the book, you see it, you'll see it on the jacket of the book. And anybody that wants to get more information about the book and the medal, etc., can email me at Brennerl21@AOL.com.
In 1985, I was living in Berkeley, California, just across the bay from San Francisco, and a friend of mine from Berkeley was in New York, and he caught a plane to fly back to the Bay Area. He gets to the plane, and sitting there on the plane was Stokely Carmichael, who was famous for being the leader of the Student National Coordinating Committee, SNCC as they used to call it. If you think of top leaders of the Black Civil Rights Movement, you got to think of Stokely, Malcolm, and King as the top names. So he rushed over to sit himself down by Stokely. And they got into a long, you know, discussion as they were flying across the United States. And Stokely sticks his hand in his bag and says, hey, you got to get this book. This book is terrific. It's all about how the Zionists are collaborating with the Nazis. We're collaborating with the Nazis. So my friend says, Lenny, I'm the author. Lenny lives down the road from me. So Stokely says, I got to meet him. And when they got there, my friend made a phone call and said, Stokely Carmichael is coming to your house tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. Now, I understand, and this is one of the most famous figures in modern American history. Every American my age who ever had any interest in politics, just reading it in the newspaper, knew who Stokely Carmichael was. He was coming to see me about my book. Right? So, but on the other hand, this was 1985, he was a civil rights leader in the 60s and early 70s. What's he thinking now? But he came to the Bay Area to give a talk at an anti-Southern South African apartheid rally. So I went to the rally to hear what he had to say. He didn't understand, he had never met me, so he had no idea what I looked like. So I'm just another pretty face in the crowd. Okay. And I listened, and of course he was you know, all against apartheid, and he denounced Zionism, which again I was not surprised since I knew he was coming to see me. But then he went on further and he said, and we must always remember to support the Irish Republican Army in Ireland against the British. I don't care what the Irish here in the United States, what their attitude is towards blacks. In Ireland, they are fighting imperialism. And you got to support them. Now, that really impressed me that he, you know, he came there. No one asked him to talk about Irish liberation, and he did. And I realized this guy is still what I knew he was in the old, in the good old days. He was an anti-imperialist. So, and then he comes to my house, and again, you know, let's just say it made my day to have, you know, this figure who was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement come to my house about my book, okay? And they, and what we did was we set up an outfit called the Committee Against Zionism and Racism, and we worked together until he died in 1998. All right. Now I want to tell you about a little something about what's in the book that he praised. But to understand, once he praised it, I could go around and tell people, you've got to buy the book, so you know, I mean, that's how these things work. Okay. Hitler came to power in January 1933. And as soon as he did, the German Zionist Federation, which is a very tiny organization, a very small percentage of the Jews in Germany, etc., they immediately approached the Nazis and said, look, you want the Jews out of Germany, we want them in Palestine. Let's do a deal. Okay? And one of the things that they did was they approached a SS man named Baron von Lindenstein and said, look, could you please write some pro-Zionist articles for the Nazi newspapers? So von Lindenstein said, yeah, I'll be happy to do it, but I want to know what I'm talking about. So they invited him as their guest for 6 months in Palestine, going from one Jewish, what you might call colony, a kibbutz, to another, so, you know, getting a picture of the thing. And he came back and wrote 12 pro-Zionist articles for the Nazi leading Nazi propaganda publication called Der Angriff, which means the assault, like a punch in the mouth, you know, an assault. Okay, this is a quote from a Zionist, this is not me talking. If we do not admit the rightfulness of anti-Semitism, we deny the rightfulness of our own nationalism. If our people is deserving and willing to live its own national life, then it is an alien body thrust unto the nations among whom it lives. In other words, it would be as if he said, look, Jews should belong in Palestine, they should get out of the United States and go to Palestine. When he's saying this about Germany, okay, read this, you'll see many quotes like that, but I'm just, you know, giving you that one as a model of what they were talking about. Now, you have to understand that at that time, 1933, 1934, the British ran Palestine. It was given to them as what they called a League of Nations mandate. They declared, we're going to build a Jewish national home in Palestine. Okay, but, you know, the Jews were a tiny percentage of the, and the Zionists were a tiny percentage of the population of Palestine. And, you know, it wasn't as if any Jew could just, you know, get into an airplane or a boat and show up in Palestine. What they wanted was money coming into Palestine with the Jews. If you didn't have money, then they limited the number of Jews that could come there as colonists. Okay. What the Zionists and the Nazis made a deal to call this Ha'avara, which means in English, Ha'avara is Hebrew. In English it means the transfer. Okay. And the way it worked was a German Jew let's say we take 100,000 Reichmarks and buy, I'm just using, you know, symbols so you get the picture, buy a tractor in Germany, and then the tractor would be taken by the World Zionist Organization to Palestine, where it would be sold there or anywhere in the Middle East, they didn't care. And then when the Jew arrived there, he would get, let's say, 90% of what the Zionists sold the tractor for. Okay? The British were happy because he was bringing money into the country. Okay? And tractors, etc. In other words, he wasn't going to be on, what do we call it now, welfare. You know? Okay. What the Germans did, now understand, anybody going out of Germany with money in 1933, the German government nicked the money as you were going out. If you were taking 100,000 Reichmarks, they would say, take 30,000 Reichmarks out of it. Okay? But if you went and bought good, if one of these Zionists bought the tractor and went over there, they only took 20% out. I'm using round numbers because it kept changing over the years, et cetera, but you get the principle. In other words, it was the cheapest way to get money out, for a German Jew to get money out of Germany. That was the attraction of it. Now, as I say, even with that, the British had kept limitations as to how many Jews could settle in Palestine. And the Zionists kept limits on it because they were a worldwide movement. They had one of their big strongholds is Poland. So if you took only German Jews and brought them to Palestine, the Zionists in Poland would say, hey, wait a minute, why should I be a Zionist? I ain't never going to get there. So the result is that only about 20% of the immigrants, Jewish immigrants to Palestine in the 30s actually came from Germany. But a big piece of the money coming in to Germany, into Palestine, was coming from Germany. So in other words, this was a bit of the help for the Jews in Germany, but a big help for the Zionists in building their community. Now, at the same time, you know, understand most of the Jews and most of the left-wingers, communists, socialists, all over the world, were trying to organize boycotts of German goods. And here with the Zionists selling German goods, okay? So, you know, and the Nazis would say, look, why are you guys over there, why are you so concerned about buying German goods? Then look, the Jews here, the Zionists, they're selling our goods. So why don't you buy them? You know, in other words, it acted to disrupt the demonstrations against the Nazis. And one of the Zionist leaders here in the United States, Stephen Leitz, wrote a letter at that time. And again, I ain't making this up. He says, you cannot imagine what I'm doing to resist the masses. They want tremendous street scenes. You know, because they kept saying, come on, let's go out, demonstrate. You know, at that time, New York City was maybe 15% Jewish. So, you know, you could put a big demonstration on, but you had to do it. And the Zionists wouldn't do it, okay? And at the same time that, you know, people were looking for places for Jewish refugees to go, you know, from Germany. I mean, since obviously they couldn't all go to Palestine, just looking for the right quote here, okay. David Ben-Gurion, who later became the first Prime Minister of Israel, got up once and said, if it's a case of sending all the Jewish children from Germany to England and only half of the Jewish children to Palestine, then I say we have to send half the Jewish children to Palestine. Because we are building Palestine. In other words, they were not looking to help get Jews into America and into other countries. You get my point? The whole thing from 1933 to 1939, the World Zionist Organization, they call it for short the WZO, was collaborating with Hitler up until the war broke out in September 1939. They were selling their oranges that they were producing in Palestine. They were selling them in Europe using Nazi boats to ship them there. Now, I mean, the equivalent of that would be if, of all of this would be as if a black group went to the KKK and said, hey, you hate us, okay, you help us get, you know, to Africa or something like that. That would be the equivalent. And of course, I hope, not too many blacks did that, but it's just that way. You know, if you get my point, all right? Now, understand, everything that I say here is in the book with a footnote telling you exactly where I got it. So if you want to go and check, you know, that I quoted it correctly, you know, I encourage you to do that. You don't have to, but, you know, it was a new home for the survivors of the Holocaust, like from Poland and Hungary, et cetera, who didn't want to go back to those countries because they also had their anti-Semitic traditions, et cetera. So it wasn't as if my parents wanted to go to Palestine and never remotely thought of it. It was to help these Jewish refugees. And basically what they were concerned about was what the Nazis did to the Jews, not what the Zionists did and didn't do for the Jews during that period. That's the whole gap between what happened and their knowledge. In other words, they were primitive nationals. My people were killed. I got to help. What was going on in Palestine, they didn't even know, if you get my point. All right. So now, at that time, the Zionist movement, and even now, is divided into different parties. Now, the World Zionist Organization, five or six parties in it, etc. One group was called the Zionist Revisions. And what that was is this. When the British said Palestine is going to be the Jewish national home, what they meant was what you and I would call Israel and Palestine and Jordan. They were all going to be part of the Jewish national home, because if you look in the Bible, the Jews settled on both sides of the Jordan River when they came out of Egypt. So he said the British were going to give them the good old time, the good old country. But then in 1922, the British said, look, we got this here Arab friend here, the Sharif of Mecca. He's getting driven out of Mecca by Ibn Saud, the Saudi family. Let's give him Jordan as his new king. Not making this up, this really happened, okay? So they took it away from the Zionists and they gave it to what they used to call Trans-Jordan, and then it became the Kingdom of Jordan. All right. The World Zionist Organization's attitude was, look, there are no Jews living there, so we're not happy that the British are doing this, but we're not going to fight them over. But one guy, Vladimir Jabotinsky, said, no. If you let the British get away with taking a piece out of what they promised us and give it back to the Arabs, that will inspire the Arabs. We got an inch today, we want the whole mile tomorrow. So you have to revise your policy. You, the leaders of the World Zionist Organization, you have to revise your policy. So his movement inside Zionism became known as Zionist Revisionism. Now, why this guy is important is that his secretary was Benzion Netanyahu. And Benzion Netanyahu's son is today the prime minister of Israel. So in other words, all this is going on in the 20s, but it's absolutely contemporary. Okay? Netanyahu, if they ask him, you know, will tell you, I am a follower of Vladimir Jabotinsky.
Another book that we're selling tonight, co-written with Lenny Bringer, called Black Liberation and Palestine Solidarity. And it's a selection of essays that we both wrote independently from 1993 to 2013 about the African-American freedom movement's engagement with the Middle East crisis, and in particular, the opposition to the colonial settler state of Israel. The book, again, being a collection of essays, tries to approach things with a nuanced discussion of racism, capitalism, empire, and state power. And these writings help us to clarify one of the most controversial legacies of Black liberation in the United States. And so tonight, with the limited time I have, what I'm going to do is I'm going to address how certain prominent African-American political leaders have engaged Zionism in the question of the state of Israel, and how they have expressed or not solidarity with the Palestinians. And I'm going to touch on, in particular, Stokely Carmichael's Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's approach to the Palestine issue, the Black Panther Party as represented by Huey Newton's statement on Israel-Palestine, and the recent controversy with Alice Walker, the prominent African-American novelist. And I'll begin there. Before I begin, let's be clear on what colonialism or empire is, right? If you go to Disney World and you think that colonialism is a great adventure, I don't know, where you go out and there's a land without people for people without lands, and people through hardy self-reliance pull themselves up by their bootstraps and make a way out of no way on the frontier. But the reality is colonialism is an expression of empire, and this is the military domination, economic exploitation, and cultural subordination of one nation by a foreign power. It's true when Britain conquered India, Kenya, Trinidad, Jamaica, France's approach to Algeria, right? The United States' approach to Puerto Rico. And one of the challenges that Zionists often make to people that challenge the state of Israel is say, well, why are you picking on only Israel? And I'm someone that's part of that tradition that criticizes nation states and ruling elites who conquer all over the world. So I'm not picking on the state of Israel, but I don't support that regime at all. I hope it continues to have poor health as a regime. And I'm very clear in my anti-fascist work that this has nothing to do with being anti-Jews, but being opposed to the philosophy that equates Jewish identity and heritage with defense of the state and ruling elite and that project in Israel. So with that said, maybe some of you would have heard that Alice Walker got into some controversy this summer. Excuse me. She had her most recent book of essays is called The Cushion in the Road. And in August 2013, Alice Walker was disinvited from speaking at the Center for Education of Women at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor because Zionists, particularly the Anti-Defamation League, publicly criticized her book, because one-third of her book was an expression and documentation of Palestine solidarity and the actual policies of the state of Israel toward the Palestinians. And in a nutshell, what she said is that the condition of the Palestinians for many years under Israeli colonialism is that they are subjected to policies that we can best understand if we compare them to experiences in the United States of Jim Crow segregation, the genocide and land theft that Native Americans have faced in the United States, as well as apartheid South Africa. And perhaps some of you have heard people use the apartheid analogy to discuss the current conditions that the Palestinians face. Now, there are racially coded license plates in Israel-Palestine. There are Jewish-only roads. Israel basically controls the water, the land usage, and the airspace over what is called Palestine. But what we have to keep in mind is that, and there's also military checkpoints that Israel runs through the spaces that are called the occupied territories themselves. And for those that don't know the geography of Israel-Palestine, I believe Brother Amen has a map over there you might check out later. Basically, what we are told is Palestine, and as the brother was just asking me, well, what about peace? What would be the terms of peace? Palestine is what we are told are the occupied territories. We're told this is the West Bank, this is Gaza, perhaps it's up for negotiation, a part of Jerusalem, maybe, might be a part of the future Palestinian state. But this is like trying to build a society out of Rhode Island and Delaware, if you know the American geography. These spaces are not connected. So even if there wasn't military roads bisecting what they call the occupied territories, one cannot make a nation state out of Rhode Island and Delaware. You see, they don't tell you this when they're talking about the two-state solution and the negotiations. And so by Alice Walker calling for a one-state solution and talking about the metaphor of Native American land theft and genocide, Jim Crow segregation, apartheid, really antagonized the Zionist interest, and this is why she was called anti-Jewish. Okay? Now, keeping this in mind, we have to realize that prominent African-American political leaders have not always been critics of Zionism. In the 20s and 30s, very briefly, both W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey, the most distinguished Pan-Africanists among African Americans, saw their movement as akin to Zionism. Even when Garvey had conflicts with Jewish lawyers, he would call his movement at the time Negro Zionism. And the NAACP was founded by Zionist Jews, with Du Bois kind of the front man, okay? Dr. King is known as a supporter of Israel, and that even when Dr. King is associated with the anti-Vietnam War movement, we are told after the fact. In fact, his opposition to the Vietnam War came at the age of 38 or so, a year before he died. And so when Stokely Carmichael, later known as Kwame Ture, leading the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, came out with a pro-Palestine position in 1966-67, this was the first time, not only in African-American history, but in American history as a whole, that put the question of Palestine in the public discussion at all in the United States. People, except for some far-left journals, one would not even know that Palestinians existed. Okay? Now, let's talk a little bit as a historian about the decision within SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, later, as Lenny mentioned, Student National Coordinating Committee, when they shifted toward a black power orientation. SNCC originally was for nonviolent civil disobedience. It's in the forefront of direct action to desegregate in the United States South, to register people to vote. And in the turn to black power, yes, ma'am?
I was going to say, it's also an antidote to paternalism in the SCLC, mm-hmm. that was mainly male Baptist preachers.
Okay, well,
so they wanted the youth to invigorate the movement.
Okay, yeah. Yes, that's true. That's true. I agree.
So I folks need to understand. Like, what
There's going to be a period after they're finished.
I agree. But so the thing is that SNCC, by raising the Black Power banner, was raising for the first time the idea of the search for African heritage, the search for identity, and it came out in public that they were for Palestine. But internally, there was conflicts about how to develop a pro-Palestine position. There was a study group led by Ethel Miner, who mentored Stokely and others, and their discussion paper came out in Newsweek accidentally, and they had a picture of the carcasses from the Zionist militias that shot down the Arabs before the founding of the State of Israel. Said, this is not Dachau, Germany. This is Palestine. This is an Israel-Palestine. And this was very shocking. And they also were talking about the need to be in solidarity with Palestine. Why only be against the Vietnam War? If you're against empire in the world, why only in one place? Why not in all places? And the raising of the Black Power slogan also challenged white liberalism and black liberalism in the civil rights movement, because people were talking about equality under the law, trying to move in that direction, but no one was talking about the terms of self-government of black people. Would black liberation be through capitalism? Would it be through socialism? This was the debate in the movement after the black power turn from around 1966 to 1972. And so the Palestine question being raised has always, in the African-American community, has always been in conflict with another type of politics that most of us are much more familiar with. I call it electoral politics, ethnic politics, and patronage politics. That is, you can't be a consistent internationalist concerned with equality all over the world, wanting to oppose empire, and also be able to elect your chosen candidate under a capitalist state. You cannot get patronage, say it's our turn, our group gets this patronage. We would like the contract for school lunches, to provide the contract for school lunches. We would like the contract to do this. Well, you can't do that patronage and wheeling and dealing behind the scenes in terms of ethnic coalition and ethnic patronage in the American state if you speak out against foreign policy issues and talk about something that would be on a revolutionary level of solidarity. And so this has always been the tension within the Black Power movement. It is a supporter of Palestine. At the same time, there's a tension because, let's face it, some black people who are for black power admire Zionists. They admire Israel. Why? Because Zionism is a form of a projection of racial unity of Jews. Zionism established somehow its own state, its own government in Israel, and some black power figures would like to imagine an independent black nation somewhere in the world. And so there's always been this tension. You see it in the writings of Malcolm X, you see it in the writings of Harold Cruz. There's an admiration for what is perceived that Zionist Jews have accomplished for the Jewish community. At the same time, it says, well, they're racist, they collaborate with imperialists. Well, what's going on here? Well, what I'm trying to underline for you is what's going on is the tension between a politics that's consistently for international solidarity and opposition to empire abroad, and the fact that people are looking for models of ethnic autonomy under capitalism. So you know there's stereotypes about Jews, of course. There's Jewish people tend to be into capitalism. There's stereotypes, of course, that the Jews are communists. I don't know if they're the same Jews. There's Jews that control the media. We've heard about this. And there are these racial stereotypes, but the point is that they suggest that the Jewish community as a whole is crafty, cunning, and knows how to secure power for itself, even though it's a minority. So there's a tension, again, between opposing Zionism, if people understand what Zionism really is, and attention and admiration for, you know, of how black people have historically looked at Jewish people in America and also on a world scale. Now, Huey Newton, in his statement on the Middle East crisis, Huey Newton being one of the founders of the Black Panther Party, said one of the challenges in the Israel-Palestine conflict, for understanding it, is that black people want self-determination. I don't know if you're familiar with this term, but self-determination suggests that historically oppressed people have a right to their own nationalism, and they have a right to pursue self-government or autonomy on their own terms, to control their own destiny. This has always been a banner of radical movements. But Huey Newton said, if you look at the situation in Israel and how the Zionists function, the Zionists claim to represent the self-determination of a historically oppressed people, right? And they've established the state of Israel in the Middle East or northeast of Egypt and west of Jordan, etc. And at the same time, they say, we are historically oppressed people in Germany, Poland, Russia. Israel is not there. They established it in somebody else's land, in the Middle East. So the moral authority of Israel is based on Jewish people being seen internationally as a historically oppressed people that have been under attack, and that at the same and the premise is that the Jewish state would be a defender, would be an anti-racist a society that would be a defender of Jews and, of course, sensitive to other oppressed people. And as Brother Lenny has shown, it has not been that. That's not what Zionism has been. And so Huey Newton was alert to that, and he said, while both blacks and Jews have a right to their own nationalism, that is, the search for their own identity, the search for their own self-government, American capitalism and imperialism cannot be an authentic sponsor for black or Jewish autonomy in the world. So that's what Huey said. So the question of self-determination, not struggle, because Huey was for struggle, right? The question of self-determination, how people will form their own liberating society and government, will have to be posed in the future. And Newton said, you know, it's very peculiar that while the United States supports Israel in the name of a kind of self-determination for the historically oppressed Jews, all over the world, American empire is against the self-determination of every other people. Certainly it doesn't want Africans to be sovereign. Certainly it does not want Arabs or Muslims to be sovereign, or Latin America or Asia to be sovereign. So why this peculiar support of Israel as an expression of the historical self-determination of an oppressed people who were oppressed overwhelmingly in Europe? And so Huey was saying, we have to, African Americans, Huey was saying, have to rethink how black folks approach self-determination. And Israel, and the Black Panther Party's opposition to Israel is consistent with racism and empire. As the second half of the 20th century moved forward, and now we're in the 21st century, we have to realize that the identity of historically oppressed people can be placed in the service of justifying empire. You see? And if we can't see that, then we are going to think that Jewish people, if we confuse them with Zionists, which are a certain type of Jewish people with a certain political philosophy, we're going to think, what's wrong with these Jewish people? I mean, are they, one minute they're oppressed, the next minute they act like white people. Are we supposed to relate to them or not? And it is funny. You know, I think about it too. I say, man, what's up with these? They're playing this game. You know, they want to be on both sides of the fence. They oppress, and they also capturing the patronage of empire. But what was Huey Newton saying? He was saying, if you think about it, Jewish people, let's separate Jewish people for a second, Zionists are not the only people that have opportunistically used the identity of a historically oppressed people to serve a reconversion of empire, to justify a new form of conquering, right? And so when we spoke in Brunswick the other night, I said, we were speaking to a black church, and I said, is there any other historically oppressed people that we could think of? I was scratching my head, working real hard at this. And I'm saying, has there ever been another historically oppressed people who have allowed their heritage and their identity to justify a government that carries out empire? Because if we could figure this out, we would realize that there's not some special conspiracy or unique quality to these Zionists who claim to speak on behalf of all Jews, who use the history of oppressed people to actually conquer another people. So I sat there and I waited to see if people could figure it out. And you know, there was a little murmuring in the background. And then I brought my talk to a close by saying, you know, in my discussion of Alice Walker's book, and again, this is the book I'm talking about that has the SNCC discussion, the Black Panther discussion, there's a discussion of Malcolm in here. These are my essays. Lenny also contributed. And there's a critical review of Alice Walker's book. And I said, look, I defend Alice Walker's assessment of the Palestinian, the plight of the Palestinians, okay? The racial and colonial nature of Israel. But one third of her book said Barack Obama is key to the future of the planet, that he's a prince of peace. That's what she said. And she said, well, I had some disagreements with him. She had a fundraiser for him and stuff like that. You know, there's the president, the leader of the world empire is not key to peace, to self-determination. The leader of the world empire is not a patron of historically oppressed people. Certainly not, you know, there's plenty of literature on the table over there from the peace alliance. There's constant bombings going on. There's no wars declared. This is the nature of American foreign policy, no matter who the president is. Okay? But the fact is that we are living in a time where to understand the Palestine-Israel problem, we have to get our mind clear, not, you know, try to shun away conspiracy theory, to not think in just narrow terms of race or narrow terms of class. And we have to realize that the Anglo-America that justified Jim Crow, the identity of America as a de facto white supremacist regime. Now we have multicultural America. And we still have institutional racism, but we have black mayors, we have black police chiefs, we still have disproportionate incarceration of black people. We still have the people of color nations of the world subordinated to American empire. We have that under a Republican president, a Democratic president, a white president, and of course now we have a black president. This is a big deal, you might have heard about
it. I was in New York during the anti-apartheid move period. Every time there was an anti-apartheid rally, I was invited to speak about Israel's connection with the South African regime, okay? I mean, every time, I mean, you know, okay. At the same time that we were organizing demonstrations against apartheid, the black Democrats in New York weren't doing nothing, okay? You know, I mean, in Congress they passed a resolution or something, but they weren't organizing demonstrations. And the atheists would go, why? Okay, the reason why is that they knew that as Democrats, between one-third and two-thirds of the private money that was coming to the Democratic Party in elections was coming from rich Jews. And all of the you know, the Democrats automatically worked on the assumption that all of these rich Jews were pro-Zionists. So a black Democrat would say, hey, look, if I get up and speak against Israel or Zionism, they aren't going to contribute money to my campaign. I got to get the black vote and Zionist money, otherwise I can lose the election.
I'm trying to suggest that Zionism is not a unique philosophy. It expresses certain racism, liberalism, imperialism, things that we found in other people's ideas. But let's face it, there are many people in the United States that believe that Zionists and Jewish people, who often are lumped together, somehow, you know, some people think Israel runs America.
No.
Yeah, I don't believe it. But I'm saying many people believe this. Many people believe that when Jewish people participate in capitalism, it's a unique ethnic characteristic of theirs. And the same people, if they got a chance to have a capitalist enterprise, they would think it's a liberation strategy, somehow a commune for their people. So the idea, you might have heard of this New World Order concept and the Illuminati concept and the Bilderberg Group and all these spooky, spooky terms about the unseen hand and the ethnic and religious character of the minority that supposedly rules behind the scenes. Well, these ideas do disrupt our thought pattern, because they mislabel capitalism and empire as the unique ethnic characteristic of a small minority that often is said to not be seen. I mean, it's just a nickname for, you know, ethnic Jews. And then he said he didn't say it, then he apologized. The thing that we have to understand about Jesse Jackson and also Andrew Young, who was the UN representative under Carter, before, I'm not sure if it was before or after he was mayor of Atlanta. And Andrew Young and Jesse Jackson, of course, were former members of Students' Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was Dr. King's organization. Jesse Jackson and Andrew Young are the kind of post-civil rights black political leaders that have used the moral authority of the black liberation struggle to promote, you know, business opportunities for their friends. And that seems, that might seem like I'm saying they're especially corrupt. They're just like every other ethnic politician. The problem is that when you link the history of a liberation struggle of an oppressed people with the advancement of a small black political class and a black business class, and then try to pose as a facilitator of human rights, while at the same time you're an open representative of the government as usual, whether on an international scale or a local scale, it reminds us that, again, historically oppressed peoples, despite discourses of privilege and guilt and what people like to talk about, people are not God's humanizing agents or redeemer people because they've historically experienced oppression. And so I think that's what we have to keep in mind about the contradictions of Jackson and Young on Israel-Palestine.
What they were trying to do, every once in a while they would criticize Israel. They would run with the fox and hunt with the hounds. One minute they would denounce Israel, and then, or say, hey, we want to talk to the PLO. And then the next minute they would say, like Jackson, I am for the state of Israel, and if I am elected president of the United States, I promise I will not speak to Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO. Same there. Okay? That's literally running with the fox and hunting with the hounds. Israeli Jews and Palestinians, whether you have a Palestinian president or had a Israeli prime minister or the reverse, it doesn't matter. The key is absolute equality before the law. That's the key. Okay? And then, of course, they have to start dealing with property and, you know, like all the settlements on the West Bank, all those Jewish settlements on the West Bank are just that. In other words, hundreds of thousands of Jews can live there. Not one Arab can live in those settlements on the West Bank. Now, that got to go. That's segregation. In American terms, we use the term, or I use the term, in the civil rights movement, segregation rather than an apartheid.
The main thing I want to see is a secular, direct democratic society where the ordinary working people, both Palestinians and Jewish present Israelis, work side by side. In the book, you'll see that I say I don't want a South Africa solution for Palestine. I don't want some figure to come forward like Nelson Mandela that leads to some kind of electoral regime that is then subordinated to American empire, and the Palestinians permanently live in shanty towns like the majority of the black masses in South Africa. But what Brother Lenny has tried to tell me, which is a good point, and maybe he'll add to this, is that the Palestine National Liberation Movement thus far has not been able to show that they want to forge a provisional government for a multiracial nation where both Jews and Arabs live side by side. Some people project the idea, but you don't see a provisional government that includes Jews in the present borders of Israel being projected as part of the government or the new society in waiting. So that is not to condemn the Palestine Solidarity Movement or the oppressed people of Palestine. That's to say that's one of the challenges before us. No Mandela solution in the sense of no charismatic person coming along and betraying the Palestinians, okay? Like really the legacy of Nelson Mandela really is. They didn't redistribute the wealth in South Africa. The workers are still being shot down in South Africa. They still live in shanty towns. I don't want that for the Palestinians. But we do need a vision of multiracial self-determination for the people that live in the under the Zionist state, within Israel, and in the occupied territories at this time.
2010, the first black president of the United States, Barack Obama, made the biggest military weapons deal in American history with, you got it, Saudi Arabia, okay? Now, understand, someone asked, what's civil rights, human rights? Civil rights usually means something like the right to vote and stuff like that. Human rights is a much more general thing. Saudi Arabia is the only country on the planet that does not permit women to drive a car. Now, think about that for a minute. The first black president of the United States made the biggest weapons deal in American history, the only government on the planet that doesn't permit women to drive cars. Now, of course, he's not a male chauvinist. I mean, you know, I mean, women want, American women want to drive cars, terrific, fine. My daughter, great, you know, et cetera. But he is the first black president of a capitalist, imperialist country. And over there, Saudi Arabia is the center, exact center of the oil industry. And they're, you know, they make a lot of money. Now they're going to buy $60 to $90 billion worth of weapons. Hey, he's in business with them. You all have to ask yourself a question, and you have to ask the black community here a question. Now that you know that he made that deal, can you be for him? Can you look yourself in the mirror and say, I'm for the guy, the black president of the United States who made the biggest weapons deal in American history, with the only government in the world that denies women the rights of a house cat? You get my point, okay? Now, the question came up of a single state. Everybody now talks about Israeli apartheid. I can come over to Israel because my ancestors were from there 2,000 years ago, and I'm an automatic citizen. Some Palestinian who was driven out by the Israeli army in 1948 and still has the key to their house cannot come back to Israel. Okay? Now, you got to get rid of that state that commits that kind of bullshit. All right? Full stop, period. Now, that's the end of the story. What do you replace it with? Well, a very good analogy, in spite of the weaknesses of Mandela, which I'm aware of, is South Africa. It went from white government, no black part of it, no way, which way, to now the guys who are killing black workers or black presidents, if you get my point, you know. Now, that's, what can you call it?
Progress.
Half a step forward. In other words, apartheid is dead, and yet, I point something out to you. Whatever its other faults, today's South Africa, there are now hundreds of thousands of whites who live there, and there's no complaints about them being discriminated against by the government, which is run by, you know, mostly by blacks. Okay? Now, that basically is what we want in Palestine. We want one country.
I don't think that any government in the world guarantees anybody any rights, and I don't think any multilateral institution would ever do that, like the United Nations. And very quickly, I would like to remind you, in response to this question, that under the League of Nations, the League of Nations betrayed Ethiopia when Italy invaded. The United Nations facilitated the killing of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo in 1961. And it was the United Nations that divided up Palestine and gave more than half the land to the Zionists to begin with. So that's the reality of international law. And a lot of Palestine solidarity activists, whether they know this historical fact or not, and a lot of black liberation activists, still have this illusion that somehow the United States or other racist regimes could be placed on trial and somehow other governments will come along and back us up and liberate us. I don't know what they're waiting for, China or some African country. I don't know what's, so we have to clarify that the international stage. Yeah, we need international solidarity, we need a people-to-people foreign policy, but we, beyond states and ruling elites, have to implement our own self-government from below. And sometimes the discussion of human rights derails that. So to the extent the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement exposes the fraud of international law, exposes the fraud of all hierarchical representative government in the world, it's a step in the right direction for Palestine solidarity as well as all liberation struggles.